Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, David, what's going on?
Not much, just a crazy day so far. I mean, Bitcoin hit $70,000 for the first time ever.
That's amazing.
Very, very briefly before dumping, as we're like, you know, right after, but it's pretty cool to see.
It's really cool. I actually have like this article in the hopper for Forbes Digital Assets about Bitcoin hitting 70K. I was about to click it, and then I looked and I was like, I don't know if I want to publish that quite yet. It's like, I want to wait till it like really hits 70K instead of dumps, which by the way, we can probably blame Coinbase. Did you hear? Coinbase yet again crashed. So now this is three times in the last couple of weeks. And it's getting to the point now where people are like, it's really weird. I mean, maybe they don't have any Bitcoin to sell. Maybe there's a shenanigan like Prime Trust style. I mean, right? Like, what's going on here? Why can't they sell Bitcoin at 70K or above? Like, what's magical about that number for them?
Yeah, I really have no idea. I think that, you know, Zero Hedge even was speculating from their main Twitter account that Coinbase is doing everything in their ability to prevent Bitcoin from breaking out thanks to the ETF inflows. But it's definitely not good for mainstream confidence in the industry, given that they associate Coinbase with Bitcoin so heavily. I mean, it's very hard for people to wrap their heads around the fact that Bitcoin just kind of exists outside of these institutions. When institutions, you know, fail or offer subpar services, it's damaging to how people think about Bitcoin, even though Bitcoin doesn't care about Coinbase or Celsius or FTX, right? But like, you remember all the articles saying, you know, that like Bitcoin was dead after Sam Bankman-Fried, who didn't even like Bitcoin, rugged a bunch of people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but okay, maybe on the flip side, there's a silver lining. I don't think this is a good thing at all, by the way. I think it's terrible, like you. Because if there are shenanigans, that's bad too. You know, I saw a tweet go by, listen, we're not spreading FUD. This is just reporting on something that we're seeing because it's now three times in a row. So, you know, what is it? What is the old saying? Once is luck, twice is coincidence, and three times is enemy action. Who said that? There's some famous.
I don't know. I like that.
Journalism.
Though. Yeah.
General said that. But like, you know, so it's not that we're spreading rumors, but this is what we see. And at this point, you know, it starts to become questionable, especially as Coinbase is also the custodian for almost all the ETFs except for Fidelity. Yeah. But there could be a silver lining because maybe people get wrapped up in the sense of scarcity. You know how like as soon as you can't have something, you want it more. So you like, oh, Bitcoin's rallying. You get into Coinbase, you can't get in. If you do understand that Bitcoin is separate from Coinbase, then maybe you're like, wait a minute, what are they doing? Like, I have to get some before they close the on-ramps. So, you know, maybe there's some minority of people that kind of see it that way. We can hope.
Yeah, potentially. It is just so interesting because banks are not banks who would traditionally be the custodians of financial instruments. Have not been able to because of this SAB 121 like accounting, these like rules by the SEC that basically make it impossible for banks to enter into the industry. So you would like traditionally an institution like BNY Mellon would be involved in this custody process, and you would imagine that they might be a little bit more battle tested or like have more resources to execute a little bit more flawlessly. But because of the political hostility to digital assets in the United States, basically the ETF issuers are, I mean, I don't mean this as a slight actually against BitGo or Fidelity, who's doing the custody themselves, but everybody else is stuck with Coinbase.
Yeah. Very strange, and strange that it turned out that way. I remember when I heard that was going to be the situation, I was surprised. I mean, I was like, oh, really? Okay. So Coinbase is doing that for everyone. Because it's not, I mean, custodying Bitcoin is not too complicated for a big company to sort out. And so this idea that everyone's outsourcing it except to one particular custodian was bizarre when it happened. Is it that, as part of the approval for the ETF, maybe, you know, the SEC smiles on that because they have one node to influence on the custody side if they ever need to. Who knows? But this is very strange. We seem to not be able to get past 70K. Brian Armstrong, please say something. You know, the guy made a comment on the first one, then did not make a comment on the second or third, as far as I know. So, like, that's also suspicious at this point. Like, are we playing avoidance games now? It's very strange. Hey, but I had a thought, David. Do you think that there's an argument to be made that Bitcoin is not decentralized enough if this matters so much? I mean, I know that it's decentralized in the sense that it is spread all over the world and it's mined and so on. And I know that price is only one important measure. There's lots of other ones. However, the fact that there's like one company that can like have a shutdown website and cause such a blow up of concern seems a little bit centralized to me.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be interesting to measure, and I'm sure there are, you know, I'm sure there's lots of data about this, but the like total, you know, I think maybe like Bitcoin or active users, right?
Yeah, active wallets.
Like, yeah, or like active wallets, active users, et cetera, that, you know, and like where they buy Bitcoin and seeing that breakdown, because I would assume worldwide, it at least has historically been dominated by Binance. In the United States, I would imagine that it's gone up and down a little bit, right? Like you had obviously Celsius and FTX and BlockFi and Gemini, which is still around, but I assume a little bit less popular with retail. I believe Gemini is actually a custodian for one of the ETFs. I don't remember which one. But yeah, I would imagine that it's gone up and down. And I think that it might be a problem, but I think it's also just a natural. It's kind of natural just because Coinbase was so early.
Or maybe are we seeing
that infrastructure?
Are we seeing a phantom? Is it possible that Coinbase crashes have nothing to do with the fact that the price turns around?
Potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, really don't know. Yeah.
Interesting. Anyways, so this lately you've been writing about fiat and the Fed. Take us through what you were talking about in this essay that you wrote about Fed bugs.
Yeah, so it's just something I think that it's really important for people to keep in mind, the fact that a lot of what we think of or call mainstream economists today, a lot of them are really just apologists for the actions of government. And that they're not, you know, these impassioned dispassionate, I guess is the word, not impassioned, dispassionate, hyper-rational academics. And so they often malign people that seek that criticize, you know, the Federal Reserve or monetary policy, and they call them gold bugs. But and there's all sorts of connotations, right? Like, you're a crazy gold bug. You think that, like, the all this, you, what, you don't trust the central bank? You must, like, your ideas must be archaic or something like that. When in fact, you can really flip that on its head and question those that believe that, you know, an almighty central bank is going to take care of everybody's issues. And Judy Shelton, who's a non-mainstream economist, but still highly respected, coined the term, I believe she coined the term Fed bug, as, you know, somebody that is basically that think the opposite of a gold bug. And the ideal kind of archetype of that is somebody like Paul Krugman. And I think that for a while, the because there was no, you know, sustained high levels of inflation, or you know, the price of gold wasn't breaking out, Bitcoin's price was, you know, not breaking out, that the so-called Fed bugs, they had a lot more ground to stand on, even though it was fairly artificial, because their kind of theoretical foundation isn't as sound. However, right now, the Fed bugs are basically, they don't have that much to point to that their kind of like system is working, besides this really, because if you think about it, the economy as a whole, the jobs numbers are not very good. The like broad economic conditions aren't very good. The debt is, it's Jerome Powell said it was consensus view to Congress a couple of days ago. He said it was the consensus that our fiscal path is unsustainable. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And yet, really the only kind of good thing in that's happening right now is the equities markets, but everybody thinks that those are very like highly overvalued, because the price to earnings ratios are very high. And then in addition to that, it's really the like Magnificent Seven of tech stocks that are carrying the S&P 500, but that's really like shrunk to the Magnificent Five. And so what's going to happen when we kind of return to Earth? I think it will be a pretty healthy correction. And obviously this isn't financial advice, just a kind of an explanation of why I was inspired to talk about this idea of gold bugs, Bitcoiners, and Fed bugs.
Well, it's an interesting phrase, falling down back to Earth, because what it implies is that we have a baseline expectation for how the economy, how economics works. There's natural laws or scientific laws. And you know, economics is, and money is sort of this elastic phenomenon that like stretches away from equilibrium and then comes back. And so what I'm envisioning as you're speaking is that these really high priced equities, these stocks, which are becoming kind of stores of value in the face of other stores of value becoming less reliable, like cash, and, you know, commercial real estate even, right? So you have this pump in these stocks, but then if you look at the ratio to their earnings and some other indicators, you say, well, it's stretching pretty far at this point. It must snap back. Now, the other thing, though, which is interesting, is that set of rules that we, like you and I, agree on and we think are well-founded and many agree on, not everyone agrees on. And there's this concept of, well, you know, you and I, we'd probably identify as Austrian economists. And then you also have Keynesians, and then you also have modern monetary theory. Modern monetary theory has a different set of baseline scientific rules and laws that it believes are applicable. And so for them, and you'll be able to speak to this more better than I can, but my understanding is that, like, for them, when the government spends tremendous amounts of money and goes into huge amounts of debt, that's not stretching anything out of equilibrium at all. In fact, that's actually just, I guess, plowing forward, because I think they would argue you could always just print money to make up for that debt if you ever needed to. And so because sovereigns have like almost perfect control over the levers of the economy through monetary policy and fiscal policy, whatever they do is like, as the representatives of the will of the people, it's like, good, and nothing to worry about. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I think that they're like fundamental. They believe that that the upper limit of fiscal and monetary policy is like the maximum that the government can do, not that it should do or like, you know, would do given like what people would expect to occur kind of like naturally. I think that and that like it's just a completely different set of assumptions, and that's why it's so challenging, because I personally think that there are kind of, you know, natural laws, economic laws, but other people disagree, and it's a social science, so it's hard to falsify these things. And we just kind of, you know, you do your research, take your bets, read everything, and kind of see what happens. And often, I mean, policymakers do the same thing, but they have, you know, politics laid on top of that. Mm-hmm. And so it's very messy. And that's, I think one of the benefits of Bitcoin, but getting into politics, did you see the Senate primary in California?
No. What happened?
Okay. So it's important to us, kind of, mm-hmm. because so the way that California primaries work, and I didn't know this, is that there's like a runoff, and the top two candidates by votes proceed to then race against each other.
And it's like so, a jungle primary or something like that? Yeah,
something like that. And so Senator Dianne Feinstein passed away a few months ago, and there was a runoff for her seat between two Democrats, Schiff and Porter, and then a Republican who I believe is like a baseball player or something. His name is Steve Garvey. But the important thing, or what I think is interesting about this, is that Katie Porter, is essentially a Elizabeth Warren acolyte who made a name for herself showing these like charts in front of Congress, where she would say like, you know, here's a chart and here are some numbers about like wages and why are you not paying your employees $50 an hour, Jamie Dimon, et cetera. Mm. And so a crypto PAC, which is a bipartisan crypto PAC, which has been created to either target hostile actors or support those who might be beneficial, actually targeted Katie Porter and spent a decent amount of money trying to get her to lose to Adam Schiff, who, although a Democrat, which that party is historically been a little bit more distrustful of the broader like crypto industry. Mm-hmm. But Schiff was apparently rated, you know, given like a much higher rating than Katie Porter, who has extensively harassed, you know, from like Bitcoin miners to you know, different, you know, crypto industry groups, etc. So she lost. She came in third. So basically the race is between the Republican guy, Garvey, and Schiff. And it was an early signal of the industry's like impact on these races, with more to come in November, like looking at Ohio with Senator Sherrod Brown, who's a big part of the Senate Banking Committee, who's been very hostile to the industry and slowed down a lot of changes. Like, for example, we were talking about banks not being able to really enter the industry. He's been a key part of that, and other races. So that was an interesting result from this kind of, you know, Super Tuesday thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, it seems like Bitcoiners are, and the whole industry, I guess, are getting better at influencing politics. There was also this big win by Bitcoin miners against the Department of Energy this week.
Yeah, that was really impressive. And I think that, you know, the industry as a whole does not spend nearly as much as other industries, like, you know, on politics, but which is just kind of ironic given the fact that I think that some of the primary obstacles to, you know, in the US are political. Yeah. Like, I think that if we could just build, we would build a lot and it would be fantastic. But there are so many regulatory hurdles, and it's a challenging trade-off, right? If you have capital to spend, do you deploy it into trying to, you know, set up government affairs operations to get your regulatory barriers lightened, or do you push forward and innovate?
Right. That's, or do you spend it on government affairs to erect those walls to keep your competitors out? Right.
Yeah.
And that also stifles the industry.
Yeah. Like,
I mean, the cool thing about all this is, so the miners came out and said, they are not going to comply with a piece of governmental overreach where, I guess the Department of Energy sent them a mandatory, survey on an emergency basis. Okay. So they, declared, an emergency. That word has gotten so abused at this point. It's like, literally, we're all taught when we're 3 years old, the boy who cried wolf, that story about how, like, don't call it an emergency unless it's actually an emergency. And you have these people. And so we learned that when we were three. I assume they did too, but I don't know if they've forgotten it or if they have the self-control of a three-year-old or what, but they apparently are just going to call anything they want an emergency in order to, like, supposedly force compliance, but it didn't happen. So Bitcoin miners came together and said, we're not responding to this, this survey, because first of all, it didn't even use the proper process. There's a process by which they need to be given a legal notice. There's a comment period by the public. They just went around all of this calling it an emergency. Bitcoin miners came together, pulled their resources, and sued the Department of Energy, I believe. They withdrew the survey and said they're going to go through a legal process. So that was a win. I think a lot of people don't realize, who are maybe more skeptical of Bitcoin, I talk to them all the time, people who are kind of sentimentally and philosophically aligned with what Bitcoiners believe, are very and rightfully concerned that, you know, if this is as powerful as you're saying it is, then they're not going to let it happen.
Yeah.
Right? They're just going to step in, and they have more power than you could ever imagine, right? The whole, like, you know, and they do on one, they seem to in some contexts, right? But then you look at this and, you know, there are several very strong constitutional cases for why your access to Bitcoin is protected by the First Amendment, you know, maybe Jason Lowry, like he says, by the Second Amendment, okay, by the Third Amendment, actually, perhaps, which is funny because it's thought of as sort of like this, like, irrelevant amendment now because it's about having soldiers in your house. But I've seen some interesting arguments saying that actually, when you have agents of the state, like snooping inside your electronic papers and effects, like they're effectively in your house. And so Third Amendment, Fourth, Fifth Amendment, both. I mean, there are so many rights that we could lean on, and not that we need to, because these are natural rights, but you know, if you want to protect the ability of Americans to interact with Bitcoin and acquire Bitcoin and own it and so on, you can lean on all, you know, this jurisprudence and this legal tradition of private property rights, free speech. And, you know, when people say we're in the then they fight you stage, I don't believe them, because I haven't seen that kind of argument really practiced yet. Like when there's a Supreme Court case that rests on an argument about private property and freedom of speech that has to do with your ability and your, you know, your constitutional right and your natural right to use Bitcoin and own Bitcoin and transact with it, then we'll know that we're in the then they fight you stage. But there's just, for those who are skeptical that we could maybe like overcome this overreach, you're seeing it right here. And it's just one example, but there's a lot of interesting work going on by Bitcoin policy specialists, Bitcoin attorneys, who are starting to lay this groundwork. And we're going to see a lot more of this and hopefully a lot more winning going forward.
Yeah, definitely. I think that a lot of civil liberties advocates and those that believe that, you know, the government shouldn't control everything you do, some people want that. I think that they need to believe that they can win. I think that they've seen 50 years of things just get worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And worse. Like no matter who's in charge, it's just, you know, it just gets bigger and bigger. And yeah, I think that, I don't know, it would be really nice if there was never a then they fight you phase, right? Like if it just went really, if the Bitcoin economy just slowly outgrew the fiat economy in a very mm-hmm. like peaceful transition, because I think that ultimately the Bitcoin economy is just going to accrue so much value relative to the fiat economy that everybody's just going to kind of, you know, jump ship. And the, it would be a real shame if the fiat economy, you know, if like, you know, actors like the executive branch really came down on Bitcoin. Because I think that long term, it's not something that can be stopped.
Well, I agree. I mean, government. There's.
Like,
I mean,
it could be stopped if everybody stopped believing in it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But okay. I guess I'm more pessimistic just because it's like the Ring of Sauron. They have the money printer. Yeah, they have a literal money printer. Like, and you know, Saifedean Ammous talks about how like there is such thing as these bloodless revolutions in history, and Bitcoin could be one, and it could be this natural process, as you say. But there are powerful people who utilize that money printer. It's just hard for me to imagine that they'd give that up. And then also part of what they would have to give up, I think, or part of this conversation is the conversation about financial surveillance. So, you know, we have come to accept only in the last few years, frankly, I mean, only since 9/11 and then the Great Financial Crisis were both notches in this direction, right? But we have now been programmed by the powers that be to think you're crazy to not want financial surveillance. Like if you have nothing to hide, what do you care? We need to know where every dollar is moving, perfect intelligence, through every supply chain and so on. And if not, then there's going to be all this money laundering and all this terrorism. And I'm not a fan of money laundering or terrorism. There needs to be strong enforcement, ongoing investigations. That's law enforcement. That's straight up just law enforcement activities. And if we want to do more of that, because we believe as a society, it's important to do more law enforcement, then we should. But we have been lied to that in order to do law enforcement, we need to give up our financial privacy, and we need to have our financial flows and transactions like perfectly monitored and controlled. And therefore, oh, by the way, like a CBDC would be so much better for that. So we just need that. And so I agree with you that it could be sort of like the momentum, like sort of the economics of the situation means that capital just like transitions from one system to another. But we are going to need to have like a serious conversation about financial surveillance, whether it's fiat or Bitcoin. It's wrong. I just think that the transition to Bitcoin might be an opportunity to address that like once and for all, and just sort of like break with the past in that sense, because there will be a group of people who tries to recreate the overbearing KYC AML system on Bitcoin. Guaranteed. They're already trying.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And if it doesn't come from the US, I mean, how does the CCP enter a Bitcoin economy?
Right.
I mean, those are two forces that are basically diametrically opposed. And I think it'll be very challenging. Although I will say, I mean, Frodo destroyed the ring in the end. Like, Sauron lost.
Yeah. Yeah. But there was a fight.
Yeah, there was a fight. That's a good point. There were like many epic fights. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings, that wasn't really like a peaceful. Frodo didn't just like walk up to the volcano and drop it in. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's true.
Speaking of survival, so New York Community Bank, what happened there? So tell me what happened. Do you know what happened? Because I just saw the headline go by. I know that they stopped trading on it. I know that they infused $1 billion. Who's they? And like, what's the background? Do you know?
Yeah. So I believe that that New York Community Bank was or is more of an embattled bank with respect to their exposure to certain like loans, I believe related to commercial real estate, because the backdrop of all of this is that offices and like the valuations of offices and then the loans that are based on those valuations and all of that is getting repriced very massively due to declines in demand. I mean, you look at, I live in Pittsburgh, for example, and there are large buildings downtown, kind of like, you know, skyscrapers, if you want to call them that. The tenants have signed these multi-year leases. The ones that like can't get out of them, they only have like, you know, half the staff going into the offices, and so they're going to be revalued unless they're like there are new uses that are discovered for them. But in some ways, these buildings themselves are like built to be offices, so they can't easily be repurposed into like apartments or something like that. So there are all sorts of stresses that are like trickling down onto banks, and banks that are overly or more heavily exposed than others. And so New York Community Bank was experiencing a lot of this stress that sent its stock price tumbling. They got an infusion of capital from a group of investors led by Steve Mnuchin, former Treasury Secretary, who actually has experience doing these kind of bank turnarounds. He did it following the global financial crisis with a bank in California that was, it was called like, it was one of the Mays or the Max, if you're familiar with that, but they like renamed it something. And they basically like tried to negotiate with all of the people who had mortgages with the bank to like, you know, they're like, we'll let you redo the mortgage so that you can actually pay us and you don't lose your house. Like it's stuff like that. But this, I believe, is a little bit different, but a similar scenario. And it's, you know, I have no idea whether Mnuchin and these investors will turn it around, but I think it's, the way I see it is it's potentially, this is just like something that there may be more of these down the line as,
Well, for sure. The commercial real estate issue is going, I mean, we've been talking for months about how it's just not sustainable. I mean, the number and commercial real estate is there's more exposure to CRE than in like community banks and regional banks than even the big banks, right? I mean, I believe they're even more like proportionally speaking, not in absolute numbers, but I think that I read that community banks are and regional banks are, you know, heavily invested in commercial real estate. They write those loans all the time. And so we've just been waiting for the shoe to drop. Now the question is whether this is a phenomenon we'll see in other banks or if this is just a one-off.
Yeah.
And in 3 days we have BDFP ending, right? So
yeah,
we'll see what happens then.
Yeah, the Fed is encouraging banks to use what's called the discount window, which is pretty similar to the BTFP. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Powell and Yellen and all these heads keep saying that, it's very contained, under control. Ben Bernanke said the same thing in 2007. So I'm not giving my take, but I am saying maybe don't believe them. yeah
all right, should we leave it there?
Yeah, I think that sounds good, and would just like to wish everybody a very happy weekend.
Have a great weekend, everyone. See you next week. Moving perfect intelligence through every supply chain and so on, and if not, then there's going to be all this money laundering and all this terrorism. And I'm not a fan of money laundering or terrorism. There needs to be strong enforcement, ongoing investigations. That's law enforcement. That's straight up just law enforcement activities. And if we want to do more of that, because we believe as a society, it's important to do more law enforcement, then we should. But we have been lied to that in order to do law enforcement, we need to give up our financial privacy and we need to have our financial flows and transactions like perfectly monitored and controlled, and therefore, oh, by the way, like a CBDC would be so much better for that. So we just need that. And so I agree with you that it could be sort of like the momentum, like sort of the economics of the situation means that capital just like transitions from one system to another. But we are going to need to have like a serious conversation about financial surveillance. I just think that the transition to Bitcoin might be an opportunity to address that like once and for all, and just sort of like break with the past in that sense, because there will be a group of people who tries to recreate the overbearing KYC AML system on Bitcoin. Guaranteed. They're already trying.
Yeah.
To.
Yeah, definitely. And if it doesn't come from the US, I mean, how does the CCP enter a Bitcoin economy?
Right.
I mean, those are two forces that are basically diametrically opposed. And I think that it'll be very challenging. Although I will say, I mean, Frodo destroyed the ring in the end. Like, Sauron lost.
Yeah. Yeah. But there was a fight.
Yeah, there was a fight. That's a good point. There were like many epic fights. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Lord of the Rings, that wasn't really like a peaceful. Frodo didn't just like walk up to the volcano and drop it in. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's true.
Speaking of survival, so New York Community Bank, what happened there? So okay. Tell me what happened. Do you know what happened? Because I just saw the headline go by. I know that they stopped trading on it. I know that they infused $1 billion. Who's they, and like what's the background? Do you know?
Yeah. So I believe that. The New York Community Bank is more of an embattled bank with respect to their exposure to certain like loans, I believe related to commercial real estate, because the backdrop of all of this is that offices and like the valuations of offices and then the loans that are based on those valuations and all of that is getting repriced very massively. Due to declines in demand. I mean, you look at, I live in Pittsburgh, for example, and there are large buildings downtown, kind of like, you know, skyscrapers, if you want to call them that, that the tenants have signed these multi-year leases the ones that like can't get out of them, they only have like, you know, half the staff going into the offices. And so they're going to be revalued unless they're like, there are new uses that are discovered for them. But in some ways, these buildings themselves are like built to be offices. So mm-hmm. they can't easily be repurposed into like apartments or something like that. So there are all sorts of stresses that are like trickling down onto banks, and banks that are overly or more heavily exposed than others. And so New York Community Bank was experiencing a lot of this stress that sent its stock price tumbling. They got an infusion of capital from a group of investors led by Steve Mnuchin, former Treasury Secretary, who actually has experience doing these kind of bank turnarounds. He did it following the global financial crisis with a bank in California that was, it was called like, it was one of the Mays or the Max, if you're familiar with that, but mm-hmm. they like renamed it something, and they basically like tried to negotiate with all of the people who had mortgages with the bank to like, you know, they're like, we'll let you redo the mortgage so that you can actually pay us and you don't lose your house. Like, it's stuff like that. But this, I believe, is a little bit different, but a similar scenario. And it's, you know, I have no idea whether Mnuchin and these investors will turn it around. But I think it's, the way I see it is, it's potentially, this is just like something that there may be more of these down the line
for sure. The commercial real estate issue is going, I mean, we've been talking for months about how it's just not sustainable. I mean, the number and commercial real estate is there's more exposure to CRE than in like community banks and regional banks than even the big banks, right? I mean, I believe they're even more like proportionally speaking, not in absolute numbers, but I think that I read that community banks are and regional banks are, you know, heavily invested in commercial real estate. They write those loans all the time. And so we've just been waiting for the shoe to drop. Now the question is whether this is a phenomenon we'll see in other banks, or if this is just a one-off.
Yeah.
And in 3 days we have BDFP ending, right? So
yeah,
we'll see what happens then.
Yeah, the Fed is encouraging banks to use what's called the discount window, which is pretty similar to the BTFP. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Powell and Yellen and all these heads keep saying that, it's very contained, under control. Ben Bernanke said the same thing in 2007. So I'm not giving my take, but I am saying maybe don't believe them. yeah
all right, should we leave it there?
Yeah, I think that sounds good, and would just like to wish everybody a very happy weekend.
Have a great weekend, everyone. See you next week.